First of all, thank you all. Really, thank you everyone for joining. It's wonderful to see so many people on a weeknight to join together and discuss important issues and to learn Torah together. This is the second in a series, a Shavua Ton, that we have this week from Beit Midrash Zichron Dov on the topic of Jewish identity. And we had a really wonderful panel last night for all those who were able to participate with Rabbi Turchiner, our Rosh Beit Midrash, and Rabbi Karapkin and Rabbi Straffler regarding the question of how the Orthodox community can relate to other communities. And tonight, I am Rabbi Sammy Bergman, and I'm going to be talking about the topic of from Evangelical Zionists to Brother Daniel, Jews and Christians today. So I just want to note that this, again, is one series in a number of shiurim, and tomorrow, please join us again. My colleague, Alex Heck, will be talking about how all Jews can unite, whether you are a settler or a Samar Chassid, whether you are religious or secular, and that will be his topic, and I'm sure it will be a very interesting conversation. So the topic at hand is obviously a huge one. We're talking about thousands of years of history, obviously, and it's obvious that I can't actually discuss all issues relating to Judaism and Jewish and Christian relations in one session. So what are we going to do tonight? What I'd like to focus on specifically is thinking about Jewish identity. And what I mean by that is often when we think of Jewish identity, we think of how we think of ourselves and our Jewishness. We think of questions of what does it mean for me to be Jewish? That's often what we think about. And that's those are really important questions to answer. There's another way to look at this question, because as we will discuss, every group identity needs to have boundaries. And part of identifying what it means to be a Jew also involves what it means to no longer identify as a Jew. Meaning, what steps, actions, beliefs can one take and thereby no longer identify as a Jewish person? And that is sort of the study that I would like to conduct tonight and hopefully see how that can lend itself to a deeper appreciation of what it means for us to identify as Jewish. So we're going to begin with a test case that is a very well-known, was actually quite controversial at the time, and that is the case of Brother Daniel. I'm going to share my screen, my PowerPoint, and we'll get started. Okay. Hopefully everyone sees this. I hope everyone sees the PowerPoint. So just to note, the entire Shabbaton has been dedicated by Esther and Craig Gutman in memory of Shimon Berglas, Zechron Levracha, and also been dedicated by Alan and Risa Litwack in memory of Mo and Rose Litwack, Zechron Levracha. Okay. Who was Brother Daniel? So he is the gentleman that you see in the picture in front of you. He had a fascinating life. In fact, I could definitely spend the whole time just telling you about how fascinating Brother Daniel's life was. But we'll run through it briefly. So Brother Daniel was born in a town in Poland in 1922. And he had a unique privilege growing up in terms of being advanced for his standing in the community, because his father had fought for the Germans in World War I. And since speaking German was seen as a way to advance in society, so he learned German from a young age, which definitely helped him in terms of getting through the war. So although he is, a simple Jew, he grows up in Poland, he is able to go to university, he finishes school in 1939 and graduates, he's well-educated, he's successful. Everything is going great. Of course, unfortunately, we know that for Jews growing up during that time, it didn't all end that well. And of course, his name was Oswald Rufeisen, I should mention. That's how he grew up. He wasn't actually called Daniel growing up. Oswald Rufeisen goes through the war. So when the Germans invade Poland, his family flees. Actually, his parents fled with his brother and he, but he lost his parents. They gave him money, and he and his brother went ahead of them, and they didn't see their parents ever again. First, he flees to Ukraine. Then he goes to Vilna. And in Vilna, he's detained by the Germans. But since he knows German, he's able to use that skill and his skills as a shoemaker to work for the Nazis. And that's what he did at that time. But the reason he was working for the Nazis, as we know, is because they confiscated a great amount of leather. And they had the supply of leather, and therefore they found it useful to have Jews who could work the leather for them. But once the leather ran out, so then there was no more use for the Jews, and he had to flee again. In fact, many of the workers that he worked with for the Germans were killed. So he runs away again, and he actually ends up in the farm of a man who he had met in the street one day who told him, hey, you want to come work at a farm with me? So he ends up at this person's farm. Eventually, he flees to another person's farm, and he's disguised as a Gentile, and he's in Belarus. In Belarus, he hears that the German police are looking for translators. And again, Rufeisen knows German, so he begins to work for the German police. Again, this is all just during the war. Fascinating story. Barely escaping death numerous times. As he works for the police, Oswald has access to classified information. You know, he ends up being a secretary for the German police, and he learns that the Mir ghetto, which is where many Jewish people were living nearby, was going to be liquidated, and thereby all the Jews were going to be sent to concentration camps or killed. Rufeisen learns of this information. He sends the police in a wild goose chase, searching for a partisan force that didn't actually exist. And so they're running after his partisan force. He uses that time to alert his friends in the Mir ghetto. He arms them and to give them the best chance of actually surviving. Unfortunately, it didn't work very well. Only 300 members of the Mir ghetto survived. He's found out. I don't know how he wasn't killed immediately, but he runs away again, and he ends up joining a group of partisans. It's actually fascinating. Originally, the partisans suspected him of being a spy, of being a German spy, but one of his friends who he knew from Vilna actually recognizes him, and therefore they say he saves his life, and that's how he spends the rest of the war. At one point, though, and here's where it gets interesting and a bit complicated, Rufeisen finds shelter in a convent, where he reads the New Testament, the religious book of the Christians, and he reads other various Carmelite publications, and he's quite intrigued by them. Again, this is a secular Jew who's running away from the Nazis. He's in this convent, and he's very intrigued by the materials that he sees. And Rufeisen claimed that he didn't see his newfound love for Christianity as a rejection of his Jewish heritage. He saw it as a continuation. You know, he saw Jesus as the Jewish Messiah. He identified with the teachings of Christianity as a way of coming back, of giving him hope in this time of despair. And he ends up, he asks the mother who's in that convent to baptize him. He actually converts to Christianity. And eventually, again, he flees. He joins a group of German partisans. And that's how that war ends. Fast forward a few years, and Oswald Rufeisen is indeed still a Christian. He becomes a monk. He joins a Carmelite monastery. He takes his vows in 1949, right? 1949 is obviously an important year in Jewish history, the year right after the State of Israel is founded. He becomes Brother Daniel. In fact, the reason he chooses a Carmelite monastery, because he hears the Carmelite group has a base in Israel, and he has a dream of one day making Aliyah to the Promised Land. And so in 1949, eventually he gets permission from the Carmelite Monastery to transfer to Israel. He decides, okay, beautiful, I want to go to Israel. I know that they accept all Jews. There's a law of return. and I'm going to live out my dreams. Unfortunately, it didn't go so smoothly, and that is because he had converted to Christianity, and so he's refused entry as a Jew. He ends up getting a one-year visa. So Rufeisen isn't so happy about this. He says, I don't understand. I'm a Jew. I identify as a Jew. I risked my life to save Jews during the war, and you're going to tell me that I'm not Jewish? That's ridiculous. And he sues the Minister of the Interior, the Israeli government, for not granting him citizenship and declaiming he's not a Jew. It doesn't work. He's rejected. The Supreme Court ultimately rejects his case for citizenship via the law of return. And ultimately, Rufeisen appeals the decision in 1962. Doesn't work. Still rejected. And although he lives the rest of his life in Israel, he never is accepted as a Jew. He becomes ultimately a naturalized citizen. And I believe he died in 1992. So that's the story of Brother Daniel. A fascinating story, a bit of a tragic story, but it's also a story that raises a lot of questions. I'm going to actually pause this share for a second. And I want to ask the following question to all of you. Imagine you are on the Supreme Court and this Oswald Rufeisen, you know, comes before the court. And he tells you a heart-wrenching story of how his family is decimated because of his Jewish identity. He lost everything. He risked his life for the Jewish people. And now he's standing there in front of you, and he says, let me into Israel. I'm a Jew. But you also know that he is a Christian. In fact, he is a monk. He is a brother. He's Brother Daniel. And my question is, do you believe that he should have the right to identify as a Jew? Or do you say, no, you can't, look, I'm incredibly inspired by your story, but you can't convert to Christianity and still identify as a Jew. What are your thoughts? What decision or what factors go through your mind in making that decision?
I feel like there must be an ability to have a compromise whereby they could grant him citizenship under a different status and not formally recognize his Judaism, but say you were going to give you citizenship because of what you did.
Right. So Chaim sort of circumvents the question, right? He says, look, we're not going to call him a Jew, but we love him, so we're going to let him into to Israel anyway. So Paul in the chat argues, look, yes, it doesn't matter, because don't we know once a Jew, always a Jew? What do you need to do to be a Jew? You need to have a Jewish mother. Isn't that all you need? Oswald Rufeisen had a Jewish mother. So don't we say that as long as you were born Jewish? I mean, don't we know of so many examples? And in Israel, this is the case also, where people were not at all religious in any meaning of the term. They didn't keep anything. And of course, Israel always accepts them. So the fact that now he's Christian, why does that mean he can't be accepted as a member of the Jewish fraternity, as a member of the Jewish people?
Can a Jew who converts be buried in a Jewish cemetery?
So Joyce asks if a Jew converts can be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's a great question. And usually we say, no, they can't. But that doesn't mean they're not Jewish. It's a great question. So Joyce, what Joyce is really asking is, well, do you really always retain your status and your Jewishness if there are certain laws which reflect the fact that if someone converts or takes certain steps which sort of negate their Jewishness, we no longer treat them as completely Jewish? So that is fair. And what we really have to define is two questions. And we're going to look at this through sort of an Orthodox perspective, because I happen to be Orthodox, and that's how we're going to look at this. But I think there's still two questions to ask. One is on a halachic legal level. There are many halachot, laws, mitzvot that revolve around being considered Jewish. And the question is, does one ever lose their Jewishness in regard to those laws and halachot? That's question one. And question two is sort of on a broader sociological level. Can we identify someone as a member of the Jewish nation? Can we identify someone as a member of Klal Yisrael if they have committed to another religion? And which sort of begs the question, is there any difference between the legal, you know, from an Orthodox perspective, should there be any difference between the legal status of a Jew and sort of the sociological, national status of a Jew? Could you, in other words, in terms of Chaim's point, could you argue that, well, maybe he's not halachically Jewish, but we can call him nationally Jewish or a member of Israel in a more broad, in a broader sense? So those are the questions that we want to discuss in terms of this first point. I'll just take a look at the chat questions just for a second. The Supreme Court deferred to the rabbis for their assessment. So that's a great point. Let me get to the sort of what happened. What's actually very fascinating is, believe it or not, there. Although we know that nowadays this question of who is a Jew is very controversial. There are very passionate opinions on both sides of the aisle. You get into all sorts of questions on should the state of Israel run based on halakhic definitions or totally civil and secular definitions. But at the time, it was almost unanimous in terms of the opposition to accepting Brother Daniel. Both sides of the aisle, right and left, didn't feel that Brother Daniel belonged as a Jew via the law of return. And I think that's on the one hand based on certain halachic factors, but it's also based on the time period, whereby right after World War II, when so many Jews suffered, people saw converting to another religion, becoming a monk, as a betrayal. And they said, how can you let someone who's done this into our fraternity? You can't do this and be called Jewish after everything we've gone through. Which is interesting, given that this person went through a lot also. He lost everything. But that's how many people felt at the time. And they saw this not in a religious sense, but in a national sense. How can you, and I would even put out there, many of the Supreme Court justices said, look, we're not following the legal, the halachic definition of Judaism, but we'll follow sort of the vernacular. And if you would ask anyone, is somebody who converts to Christianity and becomes a monk Jewish? There's no way that they would say yes. Of course they're not. No, they're Christian. You can't be Christian and Jewish. Isn't that what most people would say? So let's explore this from a halachic perspective. And I'm going to try to engage the audience, but I'm going to pause at specific points and junctures for questions. I know there's going to be a lot to ask. What does the Talmud have to say about this? Let's go back to the PowerPoint. Okay. So, one second, please. I'm just having trouble switching. Okay, here we go. The question is an apostate still a Jew? Right? That's the question. Is an apostate a Jew? Now, although that question might seem a bit straightforward, in halacha, nothing's ever straightforward. If you've ever learned a bit about Jewish law, things are always very complicated. So we have to define our terms. What do we mean by apostate? And I'm using that term in a bit of a loose way tonight. What do we mean by someone who rejects religion? And obviously, I'm not talking about someone who sins from time to time. We all do that. No one's perfect. I mean someone who is rejecting it in an affirmative way. What do we mean? And in what sense do we mean, are they a Jew? There are many areas in the halakha which all revolve around definition of Jewishness. And and whether you're a Jew for one may not be the same as being a Jew for the other. So let's identify some of these categories. Number one, if there are many, and this is many of this, as I will elaborate later, is based on an article of Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha, wrote in his book, Leaves of Faith, is chapter 3, called Brother Daniel and the Jewish Fraternity. And he lists, Rav Lichtenstein lists 5 types of apostates. 5. There are many varieties and flavors of apostate. Number 1, There's something called a musumad, or really a mumar, but he uses the term musumad, ochel nivelo v'teavon. That means that there's a person who purposefully and willfully sins, but not out of spite for religion, only because they just decide, look, I want it too much. I can't abide by that. A person who decides they have this incredible craving for a cheeseburger, and they consistently, willfully, will partake in cheeseburgers and basar b'chalav, and they consistently don't keep kosher, and they tell you, I don't keep kosher because I don't want to, because I enjoy non-kosher food. That is the type of mumar we're talking about here. You know, again, we wouldn't normally call that an apostate. That's one category. That is a category in halacha, which may have certain ramifications, which we'll elaborate on. Beyond that, we have someone who is a mishumad lahachis, which means that they don't only have this urge or temptation which drives them toward willful abdication of halacha, but rather they don't keep halacha, they don't keep Jewish law in spite. They're rebellious. They say, who needs this stuff anyway? I don't like any of it. Who needs it? I'm going to sin. But the type of person who will specifically, I don't know, take a ham sandwich on Yom Kippur while driving to rack up as many sins as they can while they go along. Again, because they say, this is just ridiculous. I don't like it. It's ridiculous. All this Judaism stuff. That would be another level of apostate. And obviously, that's obviously much more extreme. You'll treat them differently. A third level is not based on the number of sins or the attitude, but specifically the gravity of sin. And that is what we call Mechalel Shabbat Beparhesia, someone who desecrates Shabbat publicly without shame, without any thought of, oh no, it's Shabbat. They desecrate Shabbat in public, willfully, purposefully, because they just don't feel like keeping it. And in Jewish law, Shabbat has unique elevated status. Shabbat is a reminder that the Ribono Shalom created the world. It is a Eidut L'Maaseh B'Reishit, and therefore abdicating, you know, Shabbat observance is seen as an abdication of our emunah, the very foundations of our faith. Beyond that, you know, what could be worse than violating Shabbat publicly would be a mishumad la'avodah zarah, someone who, again, willfully, consistently, purposefully engages in idol worship. And, you know, obviously we could spend a lot of time defining idol worship, and that discussion will be relevant to this conversation. But say, in the olden times of the Gemara, someone who is a pagan, who will go to a pagan temple, who will give sacrifices to whatever pagan deities that they used to worship back then, and they're not ashamed of it. They admit to this. And even if they also will, you know, light a Hanukkah menorah or eat matzah on Pesach or keep many mitzvot, the bottom line is once you worship idolatry, you are no longer considered a full-fledged member of the fraternity. And finally, we have Mishuma v'chol haturah kula, someone who just chucks the whole thing. I don't keep anything. I do whatever I want. Not any particular sin. All sins. They're done. So those are our categories of apostate. Okay? Any questions upon that? Any things I need to clarify? Okay, good. So what do we mean by when we ask, are they Jewish? Are they fully Jewish? Well, there are many different categories. So Lichtenstein has three. I think you could break them down into more, but primarily three. Category one is, can we rely on them for mitzvah performance? And this is very, I think, intuitive, right? If someone is willfully saying they no longer keep mitzvot, it's hard to rely on them for mitzvot. If someone, even someone who is saying, I don't keep kosher, to then rely on them to slaughter an animal for you, is something that you can't do. They're no longer relied upon for that particular mitzvah. And there are many examples we can give. Can they write a Sefer Torah? Can they sign on a document? Can they give a bill of divorce? That is one category, mitzvah performance. So that's not actually that surprising. Meaning, to say someone's not Jewish in terms of the fact that they can't perform certain mitzvot as a normal or full-fledged member of the fraternity can, isn't so surprising, I think. That we understand. A bit more controversial or provocative is the notion of intrapersonal mitzvot. Meaning, we have, as Jewish people, as members of Am Yisrael, certain responsibility toward other members of the fraternity that go beyond the simple, basic decency that we need to show toward every human being. Obviously, every human being is B'Tselem Elokim. We value every person. But we go above and beyond for members of Am Yisrael. And the question arises, at what point does a person's sinful behavior take them out of that category? So for instance, for obligations like charging interest, for obligations like returning a lost object. So, you know, charging interest is a normal thing to do. It is an important part of business. In fact, we've often found ways to charge interest even to Jews nowadays because it's such an essential part of business life. So to say that we're going to charge someone interest even though they're biologically Jewish is an interesting notion. You know, you can't charge a Jew interest, but maybe you can charge someone who is an apostate on one of these levels interest. Now, again, that is sort of questioning their Jewishness. But for this, there's a certain idea of the being achicha b'torah u'b'mitzvot, being our brother in terms of Torah observance. And many of these intrapersonal mitzvot in the Torah specify that you need to do it for achicha, for your brother or your sister, for the fraternity. And if someone is no longer part of that fraternity, they're no longer part of the covenant, they're rejecting it willfully, we no longer go above and beyond for those people. Again, these are all independent questions, but whether or not you have to return the lost object of someone who rejects Judaism is an interesting question. But all of those, I think, are pretty understandable. Meaning, it could be you are Jewish. We're saying you're Jewish, but we can't rely on you for mitzvah observance because you're telling us you don't keep mitzvot. And number two, you're not part of achich achenu b'torah u'b'mitzvot. You're not part of the mitzvah fraternity. You're not part of those who subscribe to abiding by the laws of the covenant. But then there is the last category, and that has to do with the inherent personal status. And that has to do with laws of marriage. So we know that, of course, there's a prohibition against intermarriage. And we know that if someone, halachically, if someone marries a non-Jew, halacha doesn't recognize that marriage. Should we suggest that someone who is an apostate would not have a legal marriage? See, that would be going much further. That would be suggesting that it's not simply that we can no longer treat them as a abiding member of the covenant. That would mean that there's something inherently missing about their Jewishness, that intrinsically, in terms of the way we identify them, they're no longer Jewish. And that's the category that's the most controversial that I want to study now. We had conflicting evidence of this. So the first forces that we have are the ones that I think you and I are used to. The idea that once a Jew, always a Jew. If your mother was born Jewish, then you're Jewish. Doesn't matter what you do. Your marriage is a marriage. And you are considered Jewish, and your children, if you marry another Jewish woman, will be considered Jewish, and that is the way it works. And obviously, if you are a woman, your children will be Jewish. So that is what emerges from the first two sources you see in front of you. Talmud, in Masechet Yibamot, Daf Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, 47a, says as follows, Taval ve'Allah harehu ki Yisrael achal devarav. The Gemara is discussing the notion of conversion. And the Gemara says, once a person, after they've gone through all the trials and steps necessary to convert, and they sat with a rabbi, and they learned all the halachot, and they went through everything, and if they're a male, they got a brit milah, afterward, once they go into that mikveh, into that immersion pool, and they emerge, they are Jewish in every single way. The Gemara says, "Lamai hilchata." When you say they're Jewish in every way, what do you mean in every single way? Okay, they're Jewish. Good, they're Jewish. Wonderful. What do you mean in every single way? Says the Gemara, "Tihadar be'u mikadesh ba Yisrael, Yisrael mumar karina be." Kiddushin, says the Gemara, once you immerse from that mikvah, it doesn't matter what decisions you make next. It doesn't matter if, you know, assuming that we think you were legitimate and you really meant it at the time, if in a week we see that you rejected everything, the convert's gone back to all their old ways, they're not keeping Shabbat, they're not even part of a Jewish community, they're living like a Gentile. Doesn't matter. If a person goes through conversion, they're Jewish. If they marry a Bat Yisrael, a Jewish woman, that's a Jewish marriage, and their children are Jewish. And it's a good Kiddushin. That's the first source. Doesn't matter what you do. You can do whatever you want, but you're Jewish. Once a Jew, always a Jew. Maybe put most succinctly by the Gemara in Sanhedrin 44a, where the Gemara quotes the Pasuk in Yehoshua. It says, Chata Yisrael, Israel has sinned. Says the Gemara, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Zavda, Afa Pisha Chata Yisrael, who, even though they have sinned, they're still Jewish. Chata, still Yisrael. Even after you have sinned, you're still Jewish. So from these sources, if we go back to Brother Daniel, you know, when you're on that Supreme Court judge, and assuming you're following halacha, the answer is let him in. Let him in. Doesn't matter. You could do whatever sin you want. You're still a Yisrael. You know, Brother Daniel didn't go to the Supreme Court and ask to do a shechita. It wasn't his question. He didn't ask to write a Sefer Torah. He didn't even ask for anybody to give a lost object. He wanted to be recognized as a Jew. That's all he wanted. This Gemara sounds like it's saying, of course, sure, why not? Of course you're a Jew no matter what you do. However, as I've described, it's never that simple. Right? There's always something that complicates the issue, and that's why we love Gemara. So we have another Gemara. And this is a Gemara in Yibamot. There's a parallel Gemara elsewhere, but let's focus on this one for now. So the Gemara in Yibamot 17a says as follows: Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav Asi Ovei Kalchavim Shekidesh Bizman Azecho Sheshin LeKidushin Shema Me'aseret Hashvatim. The beginning of the Gemara says as follows: You know from Tanakh that the ten tribes other than Yehudah, Binyamin, Sheva Levi, were exiled away from Israel to faraway lands, and we don't know where they are. At least the Gemara is saying we don't know where the 10 tribes went. So the Gemara says, whenever you, even if someone marries a non-Jew, which should not be a legally valid wedding, how do you know that person's really a non-Jew? Maybe they're Jewish and they're a member of the 10 lost tribes. Who knows? How can you definitively say that the marriage is illegitimate and allow that person to remarry? Maybe it is legitimate. Maybe they're really Jewish. And that's the beginning of the Gemara. That's the Gemara says, Shema mi'aseret ha-shvatim, maybe they're a member of the 10 lost tribes. Now the Gemara goes back and forth. Well, why would you assume that? Don't we follow the majority? What percentage of people are actually going to be from the lost tribes? Very low chance. No, because if it's from a specific place where we know they're there, you can't rely on their majority. Back and forth, back and forth. Ultimately, the Gemara says as follows. Because the Gemara says, we don't follow this. We don't treat them as... we don't worry that a non-Jew, a Gentile, is actually a Jew. If somebody marries someone who we assume is a Gentile, we say it's not good kiddushin, and that's it. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes. Says the Gemara, because it's the following. Ikka de Amri. There are those who said, Ki Amrita Kameh de Shmuel. Amr Le. Shmuel said as follows. Lo Zazu Misham Ad Sha'asa Obdei Kochavim Gimurin. They didn't move from there until they being the rabbis, the conglomerate of rabbinic authority, they didn't move from there until they made them idolaters. And here, Ovdei Kochavim means Gentiles. It means non-Jews. Shene'emar ki b'Hashem bagdu ki banim zarim yaladu. For they have betrayed God, and they have begotten foreign children. Says Shmuel, you know what happened to the Aser HaShvatim, the 10 lost tribes? Well, they were Jewish, but then we lost them. Then we don't know what happened to them. They had no contact with the Jewish community. For all we know, they are completely assimilated, not a trace of Judaism. The rabbis got together, took a hammer, put it to the gavel, and said, they're not Jewish. That's it. We hereby declare that they are Gentiles. And that is the second Gemara. So now we have a problem, don't we? On the one hand, we have this first source. First source says, once a Jew, always a Jew. On the other hand, we have the second source. And the second source says, no, the rabbis will get together at some point and declare, you are not Jewish. How can they do that? Don't we say, once a Jew, always a Jew? So this is our problem. Before I go on, I want to stop for a second, take any suggestions or comments. How would you try to solve this issue? What do? We have a contradiction, two sources. One source says, you're always a Jew no matter what you do. But the second source says, you can lose your Jewishness. And not only that, the rabbis can take it away from you. I don't want to make the rabbis look evil here. They're doing it in the best interests of the Jewish people. It's not like they're just trying to, you know, kick people out of the club. But the rabbis are vested with the authority to declare that people aren't Jewish. How can they do that, and what do we do about the first source? Any thoughts or suggestions? Or if I ask it differently, how might you distinguish between a person who converts and then ultimately no longer is observant, and the 10 lost tribes? What difference do you think of? Please.
I'd say that the person who converts, you can track their source of Judaism, but if somebody's from the 10 lost tribes, they're unable to prove any link, any maternal link. Like it's, even today, like somebody comes from like Russia, without papers showing that the Rabbanut won't recognize their Yiddishkeit because they can't prove their lineage.
Right. So Morris makes a very interesting point, and it is obviously very relevant nowadays in terms of people who claim that they are from the 10 lost tribes. You have such people. Amari Stoudemire, a well-known basketball player, originally claimed the same thing. You have people who make these claims. And Morris mentions the notion of proof. So proof is an interesting one. Proofs to me means that technically they're Jewish, but we can't believe them, right? And if somehow they had some bona fide evidence that, no, look at my DNA, I'm telling you, I'm from the 10 lost tribes, then that would work, it's just we can't believe them. So that might be a way of sort of putting away the second source. You could suggest that what the Gemara really, really means is just that we don't think any of them stayed Jewish. We don't think it happened. We don't have any evidence of it. There's no reason to assume it happened. They've been gone for so long. They've been gone for generations. They probably intermarried and assimilated, and voila. That is one way to take that source. So thank you for that. Any other suggestions before I move on? Yes, Leona. I can't hear you. I'll mute you. Can you please unmute? I don't know if there you go.
You can hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's an interesting question. In terms of the lost tribes, I mean, maybe we'll be finding them one of these days. I don't know. Some of them in India, and somebody said that the Pashtuns in Afghanistan have very strange customs which are reminiscent to Judaism. So it's possible. But there are other dilemmas that appear. For example, what happens if there's a convert to Judaism with very good intentions and plans to keep all the mitzvot, marries a Jew, has children, and later on, and I'm telling you this because it was something that I experienced when I was teaching school many years ago, and the children were in the school, in the day school. And she reverted back to her Christianity. And there was a very serious question now, what about the children? Are they now considered no longer Jewish? I don't know. What does the halacha say about that?
Let's get to that. Let's get to that. Okay. That's basically our question. So I see that I'm running out of time, so I'm going to move a bit quicker now. But thank you all for your suggestions. Okay. Let's get back to our slideshow. Okay. So what do we do about this contradiction? So there are those who suggest that, you know, it's not such a big contradiction. Really, you can never lose your Jewishness. And there's something unique about the 10 tribes, an exception. So one approach to suggest that is that, as we already suggested, we know that they're not Jewish. It's not that there's anything that they lost or Jewishness. The rabbi has just declared, we think they all intermarried, and now over the years, none of them are Jewish anymore. Another suggestion by Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, prominent commentator on Gemara from 13th century Spain, argues that it's not a general rule, but we do have a specific license for the Rabbanan, the rabbis, to revoke a marriage. It's called something called Afke'inu. It's based on the notion that Jewish people get married with the consent of rabbinic authority. And therefore, there's a unique dispensation in very limited circumstances for rabbis to revoke marriages, and that's what they did. They're really Jewish, but we're just saying it's not a good marriage. And again, this doesn't mean that if somebody came, you know, what it means is that we're not worried that a non-Jew might be from the lost tribes because the rabbis are saying their marriages aren't good. But there is a more fundamental approach, okay? And it's already in the Gaonim. Without getting to some of the details, there is a rule in Judaism called Yibum and Chalitza. For those who may not be familiar with it, the rule is in Judaism that if a person gets married and does not have, unfortunately, dies without children, and they have a brother, so their widow has to either... we don't do this anymore, but can either marry that brother and take him as her new husband, and that's called Yibum, or they can do Chalitza. It's a ceremony where involving the removal of his shoe. That is what we do today, sort of severing their connection, and then she can marry whoever she wants. But that is something that's incumbent upon a person who passes away and leaves a brother. And they never had children, their wife has to go and either perform Yibum or Chalitza. So the Gaonim were wondering what happens in two scenarios. What happens if A, the brother who survived is a Mishumai, someone who converted to another religion? Is that woman still obligated? Is she still tied to that brother such that she needs to go through Yibum or Chalitza? And the other scenario is, what if the husband himself converted to another religion and then they die? Does the woman, to restore that marriage, need to go through Yibum or Chalitza? And some Gaonim suggested that they don't need to. And they rely, I'm sorry, I can't take questions in the chat at this point, we're a bit short on time. The Gaonim said you don't have to, there's no obligation. And they in their decision on the Gemara we read, on the decision of the rabbis to revoke the Judaism of the members of the lost tribes. So how do you explain that? So here we get to the Chiddush, the innovation of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. Chaim Soloveitchik was a brilliant Talmudist from the 19th century. He really revolutionized Talmudic discourse, and he argues something remarkable. It really is just quite remarkable. He says as follows. Ultimately, I won't read the whole thing inside for lack of time, but it goes as follows. He says this based on the Rambam. It's not that the rabbis are simply responding to a unique case. So Gemara and Yibamot teaches us that you can lose your Jewishness. He says that the rabbis, if a group of people are removed from the Jewish community, they're completely assimilated. First, he says the rabbis can uproot their Jewishness. Then he says, it's a general rule, right? The way he says it is that if a group of people are so assimilated such that they don't view themselves as Jewish, And even the surrounding, you know, neighborhood of Gentiles also see them as Gentiles and not Jewish. Then the rabbis can uproot their Judaism. And then he says it's not even uprooting. It's not the rabbis don't need to uproot anything. It is a natural result. If a community gets to the point where they're completely disconnected from the Jewish community, where they're so assimilated, they no longer identify as Jews, no one identifies them as Jews, there is a natural loss of their Jewish sanctity. It happens automatically. It's not that they're Jewish, but we treat them as non-Jews. They don't have what we call Kedushat Yisrael. They don't have the full-fledged status of being a Jew in Halacha. And the Rav, Yashar Ber Soloveitchik, who hopefully we'll get to a bit in just a bit, says that this is incredible. This is a great idea. What a chidush. What a novel idea. It is incredible. And the simple level is you shouldn't. But why? Well, how do we understand this? Rav Lichtenstein, in this article, and here's a picture of him, Rav Aaron Zichron Lebracha, argued as follows. He said there's two types of apostates. One type of apostasy is apostasy of action. That means when you are sinning. Now, when you are a sinner, there are certain consequences for that, but you never lose your Jewishness because you're still identifying as a Jew. Your personhood remains the same. Your activity resembles that of a Gentile. But as long as you're part of the community, as long as you see yourself as Jewish, you're still you have Kedushat Yisrael. Then there's an apostasy of person, someone who no longer identifies as Jewish, someone who completely assimilates, someone who is no longer part of the community. And he says that type of person loses Kedushat Yisrael. To quote his article here, I would love to show it to you inside, but I just don't have time. He says such persons are not simply disqualified because of some apostate act, nor are they merely treated as if they were foreign. They are people who have betrayed God. They have begotten foreign children. Namely, that part of being Jewish isn't simply a question of what you do. It's your identity, your association with the fraternity of Jews. Do you see yourself as part of the Jewish destiny? Do you see yourself as tied to the history of Klal Yisrael? When a person loses that basic connection to Klal Yisrael, to Knesset Yisrael, to the assembly of Israel, they are no longer Jewish. Now, this is quite remarkable. And Rav Lichtenstein says a number of things. First of all, this is hard to know. When do we say that a person has done this? When do we say that they've completely disconnected? And when do we say they're simply a sin? Is not an easy question to pin down. Furthermore, he says that while we're saying they lost the saint or Jewish sanctity, he argues that it's very possible if they come back, if they repent, they don't need a new conversion because they're still the same person. There is something to the biology. He's saying, and furthermore, you know, we wouldn't say, well, you're not Jewish. You can do whatever you want. You don't got to keep Shabbat. You could, you know, eat non-kosher. If they asked us, we wouldn't tell them that. They still had to. Because they are, what he says is, they're a Jew without Jewishness. They're a Jew just in the very biological sense of the term, but in terms of almost no ramifications for it. They lose their sanctity. And your Lichtenstein says, regard to Brother Daniel, while you could have argued that, you know, somebody who may identify as a non-Jew for other purposes, for instance, getting into university, you know, that would have been one question, but Brother Daniel is not simply a Christian. He's a brother. He's a monk. And that is a clear identification with Christianity. And number two, Brother Daniel isn't simply, this isn't a question of paganism. Christianity, argues Lichtenstein, is exclusive. It's not Jewish. It's a break from Judaism. It's a new covenant. It's the belief that there's a new covenant which supersedes Agris of Aaron, supersedes at least on a universal level, maybe not for the Jews, but supersedes the original covenant. You don't need to keep that first covenant. That is a break from Judaism that results in the convert losing their status as of Jewishhood. Okay, So that's Brother Daniel. That's what Wittgenstein's argument. So now with the remaining time we have, which unfortunately isn't so much, I want to use this opportunity to get at the bigger question, which is, we're suggesting now that basically Jewish nationhood has boundaries. This isn't you're in it no matter what you do. There are indeed boundaries. Every identity has to have boundaries. There is a point in which when you cross that line, we can no longer actually call you Jewish. It takes a lot, but you can be crossed. But what if we ask another question? What if I grant you that Brother Daniel is indeed not Jewish? But can we still identify him in a broader way? You know, there are so many wonderful Christians nowadays. We feel that we share certain biblical values with them. They do, even if they understand it differently, they do embrace the Old Testament. They see it as revelation. Many of them are very friendly, especially nowadays. They're paleo-Semitic. They identify with Israel. They support Jewish causes. And we feel a certain fraternity with them. So can we argue there's a Judeo-Christian community? Is that legitimate? And I'm not going to have enough time to fully address this, but let's do what we can. So there's a landmark essay by Rav Soloveitchik from 1964, where he was talking about the notion of interfaith dialogue. And I'm not going to be able to get how he introduces this, but Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests in a nutshell as follows. As humans, we have sort of three spheres of relating to otherness, to others. So the very basic level of humanity is sort of being a creature of nature, being part of the world, just like the animals, and trying to sort of feed ourselves as much as we can. That's like a basic level of being a being, a natural creature in this world. Beyond that, there's a level of humanity, where Adam and Eve look at the world as a subject looking at an object. And we're all humans together looking at this world and trying to make the most of it. It's sort of like Adam 1, for those who are familiar with Lonely Man of Faith. And then there's the third level. The third level is where we look at other people and we recognize that they are subjects as well. They are not people who we study, but they have a certain part of them that we can't ever fully appreciate. And we have a part of ourselves which only we can appreciate, and we need to work together. And we can't infringe upon each other's individual unity. And the notion of Adam and Chava uniting is the notion of husband and wife realizing that there's a certain loneliness there and they won't ever fully be able to breach that gap, but they unite anyway. It's a remarkable way of looking at it. But he extends this to nationhood and faith communities. And he basically says as follows. We Jews have two roles. We have the role of humans, and we have the role of our unique faith community. And he argues that as members of society, we have a responsibility to partner with the other members of the human race, whether regardless of their religion, and to make the world as wonderful a place as we can. But we also have a unique, singular faith experience. And Rabbi Soloveitchik argues that if we try to sort of blur the lines between faiths, to sort of break down those boundaries and say, well, you're Jewish and I'm Christian, but we have this commonality, then that is a grave mistake, because you can't do that, because we're both subjects. We have to let every person and faith community appreciate themselves for who they are. And it's a problem to sort of, you know, blur the lines. And he points out every faith is different than others. And specifically in regard to Jewish and Judaism and Christianity, he points out three cardinal differences. Number one, divine imperatives, right? It's obvious that although there's commonality, Jews have halacha, we believe in the Torah and the mitzvot, and the Christians don't have it in the same way. Even in regard to the mitzvot they do observe, it's not the same, right? So that they might observe Sabbath, but that's not our, like they might suggest that they observe the Ten Commandments, but their Sabbath is not our Sabbath. Number two, in terms of dogma. Now this gets into a very difficult question as to how exactly on a Jewish level we understand the Christian belief system. And I could spend the next 10 years talking about that. and frankly, I'm not going to. But be it whatever, however you see it, we don't have the same belief system as the beliefs of Christianity in terms of our conception of monotheism, in terms of our conception of the person of Jesus. We certainly don't agree. However you look at their conception, whether you see that as idolatry or not idolatry or sort of a diluted form of monotheism, it's not going to be the same. And finally, in terms of eschatology, meaning our vision at the end of days, and our salvation makes a pretty important point. He says, we as Jews believe with full conviction that at the end of time, everybody will recognize, we say it every day in Aleinu, right? L'tachin olam machot shakai, akirvi dekoyo shei tevel. Everybody will recognize God, Hashem, as the one and true God and reject all else. And Christians believe that at the end of time, everybody will recognize their Messiah as the true God. I'm sorry, I can't take questions now. And that's the way it is. And Rosal Dachik argues it would be disingenuous for us to try to convince Christians to reject their worldview. And of course, it would be disingenuous for them to reject our worldview. And if we think Christianity is idolatry, then we think that. And we shouldn't be apologetic about it. And if the Christians think that we have some corrupted vision of Messiah and we're missing the ball, then they have the right to think that. And we shouldn't blur those lines. And so essentially, Rabbi Soloveitchik argued that interfaith dialogue in a certain sense is appropriate. It can be appropriate culturally. It can be appropriate. We can get together because we do have certain historical commonality. Judaism influenced Christianity, and we can get together based on our values and fight for certain rights like religious freedom or maybe the right to life or things of that nature. But in terms of theological inquiry, in terms of discussing questions like the unity of God, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, no, don't do that. It's going to lead to a bad place. It's going to lead to sort of a compromising and dilution of each faith community, and that's not appropriate. Okay, so in 3 minutes, I'm going to very, very briefly give you what's happened since then, do a bit of a recap, and I'll stay for a few minutes for questions. Okay, and I'm sorry I'm rushing here. It's a lot to say. That was Rabbi Soloveitchik's view, and that was essentially the RCA statement adopted in 1964. I can send you the PowerPoint if you're interested. You can look at it. That we respect Christians for who they are. They should respect us for who we are. We can work together on cultural issues, but we cannot work together on theological issues. Never the twain shall meet. Well, a lot happened since then. Number one, just to briefly summarize it, 2 years after this statement by the Rug, there was a proclamation by the church, number one, no longer tolerating any form of anti-Semitism, no longer blaming Jews for the slaying of their Messiah, and they expressed the desire for dialogue, for fraternity. They appreciated that Jews and Christians both come from the same, you know, sort of background. We both worship the same God. We should get together and we should talk. Again, I'm sort of summarizing and diluting it, but it was much more friendly. Furthermore, we know Jews and Christians get along in many circumstances, not all, but there are many Christians that we get along very well today. And they're no longer trying, at least often they're not trying, to convince us of their religion. So some have argued that maybe the Rav Soloveitchik's concerns are no longer so well-founded. Maybe nowadays Christians are very friendly. We can have dialogue. They're not going to try to convince us to be Christians. We're not going to try to convince them to be Jewish, but we can still talk about notions of God or spirituality or have discussions about how to interpret the Bible because there's no threat. We're all friends. We're friendly. And we do, in some sense, you know, some have even argued worship the same God. Some have argued as much. And furthermore, there's a lot to gain from interfaith dialogue. If we believe in a sort of universalism, we want to get the whole world to call to God, isn't it incumbent upon us to bring our theories of religion toward Christianity to at least tell them how we think God should be recognized and worshipped? And if we're not sort of proselytizing, at least to have that discussion, isn't that part of our mission? So essentially today you have different opinions on this matter. You have different schools. You have some, like Rabbi David Rosen, who is very involved in interfaith dialogue arguing for this, that we can sort of, you know, assimilate. We can, or Nachum Rabinovich argues for reassessing the way we look at different religions. I know I'm throwing through this, but there are different schools of thought. There are some who now believe that it's more safe, where others are arguing, no, that it's not safe, that even if they're not openly trying to convince us of their doctrines, but still, the very dialogue can lead to that. And, you know, if I tell a Christian, I think you're an idolater, and I think you have a completely warped sense of God, and you should reject Christianity, and they say, that's really harsh, you know, that makes me feel bad. And would you mind sort of toning it down a bit? Maybe you should, like, resolve that Christianity isn't idolatry. Well, then that's a problem. And that we shouldn't tell them that they can't argue that we're all going to have to convert one day, because they should believe what we believe in, and we believe what we believe. So this is still an ongoing conversation. I know I rushed through it, but these issues are very much still at hand. So I'll just sort of answer these questions very briefly, and I'll take any questions that you may have. Our first question was, can a Jew lose their Jewishness? And I think the answer to that we're saying is yes. In a very profound sense, yes. It takes a lot. It's not simply sinning. But if a person completely assimilates, adopts a new exclusive religion, or Lichtenstein or Chaim Soloveitchik argue, you can lose your Jewishness. And we could ask for which halachot, but you can. Can you be a member of both the Jewish nation and the Christian nation? But Lichtenstein argues that no, you cannot. They are exclusive. Should we see ourselves, though, as a part of a greater Judeo-Christian community? That is up for discussion. That is an interesting question. I don't think there's a clear answer to that. Some would say every faith community is distinct and separate, and some would say, no, there is commonality. We can have dialogue. Although there's a Jewish community and a Christian community, there is some sort of commonality of worship, and we can have a certain fraternity with them. Under what circumstances is it appropriate? You know, without going into specifics, I think it has to be that a mutual respect, number one, for each and each other's value of each religion. And furthermore, there has to be a certain knowledge of self that one won't sort of surrender their primary beliefs and doctrines due to a peer pressure involved in talking with someone who rejects them, even if it's friendly discussion. And finally, how do we approach today's Paleo-Semitic Zionist Christians? I think we certainly should be very thankful that so many people are embracing us. I think that we have to count our blessings, and that we have to count as allies anyone who is theistic, anyone who embraces the value of religion in a world that's growing more and more atheistic. I think we can take their support, but there do ultimately have to be boundaries, because part of Jewish identity is not simply, you know, how we feel as Jews, but it's also knowing that at some point a Jew can't cross a certain boundary. And it's knowing that I might love a Christian or many Christians, but I can't identify with their faith community in the way that I identify with my own, and that I don't have the same belief system as they do, and I can respect them for who they are, but they need to respect me for who I am as well. Okay, so I'm sorry I ended up rushing so much at the end there, but I hope you found that interesting and informative. And